Good evening and welcome to Massage Therapy Radio. I'm your host, Don Dillon, and this week's topic is Better Business Agreements, A Lawyer's Perspective. Tonight's seminar is part of a series entitled 10 Weeks to a Better Massage Business, produced by MT Coach. You can hear replays of past shows by visiting www.mtcoach.com. Our guest tonight is lawyer Leanne Standrick. Leanne Standrick is a partner of Lancaster, Brooks & Welch. Ms. Standrick began her practice at LBW in family, civil and labor and employment law. Currently, she specializes in labor and employment law and has experience in advising management in matters of human rights, contract negotiation, wrongful dismissal, labor relations, and workplace privacy and risk management issues. Leanne represents a number of national sports organizations with respect to athletes and selection appeals, risk management, employment issues, and general contract issues. I'd like to add a personal point that Leanne is also very active in supporting local sporting organizations within St. Catharines and charitable causes as well. Leanne, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Don. It's my pleasure to be given the opportunity to address the group listening tonight, so thank you very much.
You know, I think I'm in a unique position, Leanne, because I think that this is the first time I've ever had a chance to cross-examine a lawyer.
That's certainly a unique situation, that's true.
Now, Leanne, you were certainly instrumental in helping me with writing the book Better Business Agreements. It was just under 2 years ago that I had consulted you on a number of common problems that were facing massage therapists, and I know I certainly learned a lot about some of the ambiguities that were affecting our profession. And over the years, I've received a number of common questions. Before we go into those questions, I would just like to let our listeners know tonight that they can field their own questions. They should be viewing the broadcast page where they can see a picture of yourself and an outline of tonight's show. And if they look just down the left side, they'll see a Q&A box that says submit your question here for the event. And if they could type in their question, and please include your name and the city that you're writing from, and click submit, we'll be able to field some of those questions hopefully on the show. We'll be getting to as many as possible. So, Leanne, one of the most common questions that I get first off is, and I'll just sort of paraphrase this from a variety of people, but it goes like this. I have a non-competition clause in my contract that prevents me from working in a 5-kilometer radius if I leave the clinic. How binding is this?
First off, Don, the one thing I want to mention is certainly I'm qualified to practice law in the province of Ontario. I know that we have a number of listeners from different jurisdictions, so I do want to be clear that the advice or the information that I provide is based on Ontario law, but certainly some of the principles are applicable in other jurisdictions outside Ontario. Now, with respect to the question that you've asked, that's certainly a common question, and it finds its way into employment relationships and those relationships between the clinic owner and the associate as an independent contractor. What you're talking about is basically a non-competition clause, which is a covenant in restraint of trade, and any provision that prevents an individual from earning a livelihood is considered by the courts in Ontario as what's called prima facie void, so it's unreasonable on its face. Now, where an individual relies upon a restrictive covenant, they have to establish, firstly, that the agreement is reasonable as between the parties, and secondly, that it's consistent with the interests of the public. So dealing with the first issue, that the agreement is reasonable, first of all, they have to show that there is an agreement entered into between the parties prior to the time in which the parties actually start providing work and services for one another. It's imperative that the agreement to be valid and enforceable be entered into before any work is done. And secondly, that the parties understand the terms and conditions of the contract, that they understand the consequences of entering into the agreement, and certainly that they've had the opportunity to obtain independent legal advice. Okay?
Yes.
Now, looking as well as at the reasonableness of the actual covenant, there's a number of factors that we're going to look at. We're going to look at how long is the restrictive covenant in place. what space or territory does it cover? And what is it that, what proprietary interest is the individual trying to protect? Is it the clients that they're trying to protect? What is it? So when you have a contract that's similar to the question that you've posed, the non-comp is for a 5-kilometer radius. Is that reasonable? You have to look at, again, how long is that restrictive covenant in place? Where does the individual primarily perform their work and services? Speaking to the area of the Niagara region, we have seen restrictive covenants that are reasonable, that have been entered into prior to the commencement of the relationship for a period of 6 months to 12 months and for a radius of 5 kilometers. That's not necessarily unreasonable. My advice to, and I'm not sure whether we have clinic owners and associates and employees on the line, but my advice to clinic owners is to really look at what you're trying to prevent. Is it the competition or is it the solicitation of your clients or the clients away from the clinic? And if it's the solicitation issue that you're concerned with, you may want to consider a non-solicitation clause rather than a non-competition clause.
You had counseled me on this issue and had suggested that in most cases probably a non-solicitation clause was more appropriate because the clinic manager was really trying to prevent the associate from moving down the street and then trying to steal away that original business, and so they would be limited for a period of time from soliciting those individuals. I think you had also mentioned as well that the solicitation would be, if I'm not incorrect, limited to the general database of patients at the clinic, but if it was a contractor situation, I believe you said that the contractor could still solicit the people that they had treated personally. Was I correct in that?
Yes. In a nutshell, yes. Now, if we're looking at non-solicitation clause, a non-solicitation clause is still a restrictive covenant. So it's preventing me from doing something that I should have a right to do, i.e., earn a living. So again, non-solicitation clauses have to be reasonable. First of all, it has to be a valid agreement, and it has to be reasonable as between the parties and consistent with the interests of the public. So the trend in the courts is to accept the reasonableness of the non-solicitation clause, provided that they find there is a real and substantial risk of harm to the clinic owner. When we're looking at a employee, Let's focus on that relationship, the employer-employee relationship. So the registered massage therapist is an employee. Can the employee leave and solicit clients from the clinic? The answer to that is, first, is there an agreement in place that's reasonable and binding? And if so, the employee is prevented from soliciting patients or clients. What they do have the right to do is to notify the clients that they're leaving and give the client the option to choose. Okay?
Yes, and we had talked about this previously, Henry, that within Ontario anyway, the College of Massage Therapists dictates that, in fact, the therapist must inform the individuals that they have treated before leaving the clinic so that they can decide, so that their records are protected and can be transferred appropriately if necessary, so that at least applies within Ontario.
That's right. Now, if assume for a moment that there is a non-solicitation agreement that's in place and it's valid, can the massage therapist then contact the individual and provide them with additional information? I'm moving to 55 James Street, and I invite you to contact me for additional services. The words invite you, they constitute a solicitation. So that's,
oh, I see. Yeah.
That's something that would be outside or in violation of the non-solicit agreement. In the absence of an agreement, there's no general implied duty that prevents you from soliciting. Mm. You must do so honestly and in good faith.
Would it be possible just before the situation where an associate may move on and start their own business, would it be advisable for the clinic manager and associate to draft that letter in advance so that it was a clear understanding that upon the day that the associate might leave down the road, that it was worded properly? Would it be worthwhile doing that in advance before things got maybe a little strained or?
Absolutely. It's always better to do it with the mutual consent. Now, keep in mind, we've been focusing on the employer-employee relationship. When we're truly into a clinic owner versus independent contractor, so
yes.
A clinic owner and associate, a true associate, that associate certainly can advise clients that they're moving and can invite them to move with them. Ultimately, it's the client's choice. Okay?
I had spoken to you about this issue, and that I believe that there's a misunderstanding with massage therapist clinic managers, and they want to maintain a lot of control over the clinic. They want to maintain the business identity or the visual identity and the business presence, and they want to control in terms of the hours that the therapist works and the way that they're working. But my understanding is that kind of slips over into the employer-employee model, doesn't it? So there's a confusion out there between whether the relationship is a contractor-client or employer-employee relationship, and this is where some of the problems, I imagine, develop.
It's where most of the problems develop, and in fact, actually, if I go right back to the beginning of your relationship with a clinic owner, it's always best to ensure that you have an agreement that reflects the reality of the relationship. Is it an employer-employee or is it a true independent contractor situation? The agreement that you establish at the front end is really the foundation of your relationship. It's like a foundation of a house. It provides the strength of the terms and conditions moving forward. When the Canada Revenue Agency, or HRSDC, in Ontario and Canada, what they will do is they reserve the right, as do the courts, to look beyond the title that the parties give to their relationship. So I get into a relationship with a clinic owner, and I say that I am an independent contractor, but the clinic owner determines my hours of work. They take care of all of my bookkeeping. I'm not contributing to any of the expenses in the office. All of the invoices are being done through the clinic owner. I'm getting paid through a central payroll, although deductions may not be taken. CRA will look at the reality of the relationship, and it has basically five tests that it's developed through the tax course. The first one is the control test, and the less control an employer has over the individual, or the less control a clinic has over the individual, the more likely the individual is an independent contractor. So that's the first test. The second test is the integration test, and they look at the degree of the integration between the individual and the clinic. The greater the integration, the more likely that individual is an employee. Who owns the tools? CRA will look at who provides the tools necessary to perform the work. Now, in registered massage therapy, that may be something that's a little bit difficult to determine. Is the clinic actually providing the room and the examination table or massage table and so forth and all of the linens and what have you? They will look to that and who actually pays for those. The fourth test is chance of profit, risk of loss, and it focuses on the question of who bears the risk and rewards of the work. And the fifth test is the contractual intention test. What are the intentions of the parties, and do the facts support their intentions? So going through all of those tests, they'll look at whether or not it's truly what the parties are calling it, or whether it's an employer-employee relationship. And, yes, that's where the problems arise.
Yes. Leanne, I think I was sharing with you that my accountant, Robert Magner, had of course, we have a lot of spas in the Niagara region, and that he was saying that a lot of the, when CRA is looking at these relationships of therapists who are driving to the spas and are providing massage and are calling themselves self-employed and they're writing off car expenses and a variety of other expenses, CRA is auditing a number of these therapists and is in fact determining that their relationships are more like an employer-employee. So I think this is something we're going to see more and more in the massage therapy field. I know that there was an actual a case both in St. Catharines and in Alberta where the clinic manager was brought up on penalties because they had misinterpreted the relationship. They had defined the relationship improperly.
Yes,
so,
and
so
when
this,
that,
this seems to me to be an issue, and I think when we were speaking yesterday, I said what I get a lot of as well is emails from therapists who said, you know, I didn't have a lawyer review my agreement before I went in. I signed the agreement, and now I'm in this particular circumstance, and this is what happened. So this seems to be a very common problem. I'm sure you could tell us in many industries, but particularly in the massage therapy field.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and you're seeing it with dentists, optometrists, general practitioners, medical practitioners, chiropractors. It's a common problem. It really is. So I know that there's a bit of a fear of the unknown, and many people, they tend to have dealings with lawyers when as a reaction to something rather than being proactive. And the reason for that is because they're not certain as to what fees are going to be charged or how long it's going to take. And really the best way to find out is to talk to some individuals that you're familiar with, some friends or some colleagues in your business community, and find out what lawyers in your area focus on employment issues and find out what their experience has been. Go through perhaps the Internet and determine what lawyers focus on these issues and give them a call. And educate yourself. Find out about their hourly rates. Find out what client base they deal with. Find out whether they have any particular expertise or experience in dealing with the issue of employer-employee, non-competition clauses, non-solicitation clauses, the ownership of the records of the clinic, and so forth. Generally speaking, what you'll find is to be proactive at the front end, obtain the legal advice that you need, to ensure that you're entering into a binding and a fair contract will prevent you from expending a great deal of money at the end of the relationship. Because at the end of the relationship, normally there is some issue about non-competition, non-solicitation. It ends up in the courts, and court proceedings can be lengthy, and they definitely are costly.
I'm, as you're speaking, I'm just thinking of the old adage, an ounce of prevention.
You just took the words out of my mouth.
Pound of cure.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. And yeah. And most counsel that focus in labor and employment like I do, we deal with the issues over and over and over again. It's something that we look at daily. And so we can take a look at a contract. We can have a telephone conference with the individual, or the individual can meet us in our office. And because we have that experience and expertise, we can spend likely an hour with you and provide you with the appropriate guidance and understanding of the terms and conditions of the agreement that you're about to enter into and propose perhaps some amendments to the agreement so that the agreement, again, is reasonable, enforceable, and it's clear and unambiguous. And it will avoid a lot of potential issues at the end of the relationship.
Well, and as I had shared with you, I have certainly seen the results of not doing that homework up front and hearing the stories of what happens afterward and of not having a proper agreement in place.
That's right. I can tell you that generally speaking, in situations where an individual leaves the clinic and the matter becomes litigious, one of the first things that counsel will do acting on behalf of the clinic owner is to advise their client if they feel that there's sufficient financial risk of harm to the clinic, they will advise their client to commence what's called an injunction application. And that's a formal proceeding in the court. And the initial steps are to obtain an interim injunction against the associate to prevent them from soliciting clients and from competing with them. I can tell you that the first step in that hearing can range anywhere between $5,000 and $15,000, and that's the beginning of it. That's of course not speaking to a full trial. So again, when you think about and a lawyer's hourly rate at the front end of the relationship to get some advice about the agreement, you could expect to spend anywhere from $150 to $300 for the hour that you spend with counsel. You're paying for their experience and their expertise and some guidance. That amount of money, in comparison to the amount that you may be required to spend in defending your actions at the end of the relationship, is nominal. We're talking $300 versus $5,000 to $15,000.
I think our listeners would relate to this metaphor, because we certainly preach this to our patients every day, that the degenerative changes that occur when there's a biomechanical problem over time, certainly it helps to fix it up front before it becomes a much more pronounced issue later on, costing far more healthcare dollars to correct it. So it sounds like certainly the metaphor for consulting your lawyer is the same as consulting your massage therapist. It's less expensive and more effective to deal with it up front.
That's right. That's right. And really, it's the individual taking care of their own business interests, which is to ensure that they're fully aware of the circumstances that they're about to enter into.
Leanne, I want to let our listeners know that they can contact you on our broadcast page. We have a link that it says Contact Leanne Standrick, and you are available for consultation on issues around contractor, client, employer, employee relations and in terms of forming agreements. So I'd like to draw people's attention to that link on the page. And I'd also like to draw people's attention again that if you have any questions, we're very fortunate to have Leanne with us this evening. This is your opportunity to field some of your burning contract questions. So please type in your question on the Q&A box with your name and the city that you're from. Now, Leanne, would you have any back to the relationship between the clinic manager and the associate? Would
so
you
we're
have
talking
point-
about... Sorry, we're talking then about the independent contractor relationship then?
Yes, most likely. That in most cases in the massage therapy field, that seems to be the relationship at this point, although I'm encouraging more therapists to think of looking at some of the benefits of employer-employee relationship, but probably a contractor-client relationship.
Okay.
Is there any points you might have in terms of negotiating the agreement when they first sit down and they've had the interview and things are going positively, and any thoughts on how they might put their best interests forward?
Well, one of the things that you want to do is determine what it is that you want to achieve out of the relationship. Is it client development? Is it really to share some space and some costs? Often individuals will get into an independent contractor relationship because of the benefits associated with sharing space and a central administration. So one of the things that you need to do is really do your homework with respect to the breakdown of the numbers for the lease and what your portion of the lease expenses will be and what your portion of perhaps the payroll expenses would be for any shared administrative clerical assistance that are providing you with services. Find out what your share of the telephone and fax and internet bills are so that those are accurately reflected in the agreement. Again, if you're sharing a portion of those costs and you have control over your hours of work, those are indicators of a truly independent contractor relationship. So go in knowing what your reasonable contribution to those costs would be. And you can, I know that many people say, well, that's information that the clinic owner has. Don't be afraid to ask for that information. Mm-hmm. You're doing a part of your due diligence. You're doing what is appropriate to protect your interests. And if there's an individual who is not inclined to give you the information that you're asking for, then question whether or not you want to do business with that person to begin with.
Very good advice. Leanne, I have a draw prize that I'm going to give out tonight, and I wonder if I could just I'm going to put out a question to our audience in an opportunity to win that draw prize, and then we're going to take one or two questions from our audience before we wrap up our show tonight. So I'm going to ask our audience members, you're looking at the broadcast page, and at the bottom of the broadcast, one of the links says to contact Leanne Standrick. So I'm going to ask you to click on that link. And that will take you to Leanne's page on Lancaster Brooks and Welsh website. Now, you'll see a picture of Leanne, and I hope you don't mind, Leanne. We're going to put some attention on you here for a few moments. And it says that Leanne received her Bachelor of Arts from Carleton University. It said her studies focused on law, sociology, and there is a third topic. there's a third focus of study. I wonder if you could type in that word in the Q&A box at the bottom of the broadcast page. So the question is, under education, it says that Ms. Standrick received her Bachelor of Arts from Carleton University in June 1993. Her studies focused on law, sociology, and there's a third point there. If you could write that in, submit that. Don't forget to include your name, the city from you're from, the city where you're from, and your email address so that we can contact you. And the prize tonight is a copy of my book, Better Business Agreements, A Guide for Massage Therapists. The first correct answer will win a copy of the book this evening. Let me take a question. This is from Christine McCoy from Simcoe. If in a contract, let me read that. If a contract states that all clients are of the clinic and that the therapist is providing a service for the clinic, I think I have to change the grammar a little bit to make it meaningful. So if the contract states that all clients are of the clinic and the therapist is providing service for that clinic, there may have been clients that have been treated by many different therapists at the clinic. The question is, do therapists that leave the clinic still have the right to notify them of their new location?
Yes, that's right. They can notify the clinic patients if they have treated them. And I think, Dawn, you alluded to the fact that the college requires you to do so as a professional obligation. So short answer, yes, you can notify that you're leaving the clinic and your new location.
Excellent. I have this is a rather long story. I'm just wondering if I should read it. It's actually an experience or a statement of what happened rather than an actual situation. But maybe I'll read it without the name, just so that some of our listeners get a sense of some of the things that therapists experience. So I'll leave the name out, but I'll read it here. 2 years ago, I let an associate go. Every time she was around, I would get heart palpitations due to her boldness and outspokenness. I had to let her go for the good of my health. When she left within 3 months, she had talked to three other associates that worked for me to start with her a new business. No contract was discussed. They just went, and their fees are quite reduced. I guess they had left. They had left, and then they had reduced their fees. Knowingly, the associates knew they were leaving my business almost 2 months ahead without any knowledge to me until the day they left when I received letters of resignation on my desk. To find out later, the day after, we do reminder calls to all our clients, and they had been contacted by these associates. I also found out later that they obviously made copies of the appointment schedules and names and addresses from my data source, I believe, and had sent out letters to them. They even admitted to copying client files, which is, as far as I'm concerned, a breach of client confidentiality without their signed permission under my care of their file. Is this not against the Privacy Act? I am pursuing a lawsuit for the last 1.5 years. My lawyer is going for loss of wages. I do not understand why they are not liable under the Privacy Code. It mentions that the individual the individual had purchased a copy of my book, and I had only wished I had read it sooner. I have really a hard time trusting new associates. Word of advice to other facilities, do not give a key to the associates. They will abuse the locked cabinets and copy what they want when you are not there. Lesson learned. So this is an example, unfortunately, of some of the comments and questions that I have been getting in our field. So it seems like, again, as you mentioned, really setting up that agreement in advance and consulting a lawyer is very important.
That's
so
right.
That we can... Sorry, go ahead, Diane.
No, that's right. So, and one of the things that comes to mind out of that comment is, you know, we've talked about non-competition and non-solicitation clauses in the context of employer-employee and in contractor situations. Now, certainly you should be turning your mind to confidentiality clauses, particularly where you're hiring a massage therapist as an employee. So that's the one comment that I want to make about that scenario. The second comment is, with respect to the question, is this not a breach of the privacy legislation? In Ontario and Canada, we have something called the Information Health and Protection Act. And certainly, if there are breaches of the duty of confidence and the privacy rights in that legislation, the process is by way of filing a complaint with the privacy commissioner. And the right to file the complaint generally resides with the clinic patient or client.
Okay.
That information, their personal health information, was taken without their consent. It was transferred and or disclosed to other parties without their consent. So generally speaking, that the recourse of action is that belonging to the client, and it is with respect to filing a complaint or notifying the privacy commissioner.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very difficult, isn't it, for these self-employed individuals to wade through all the different forms of legislation, many different levels of legislation that we need to be aware of. And again, another reason to build a relationship with your lawyer in advance before you have any problems.
That's right. That's right. And again, from my perspective, you really want to engage counsel that has a specialty in the area that is of concern to you. So if you are thinking about, and this is just by way of an example, if you're a clinic owner and you're thinking, should I incorporate my clinic? Well, you'll want to talk to someone who specializes in corporate and commercial law. Although that individual could provide you with some information about non-comps, non-solicits, and confidentiality clauses, that expertise typically lies within the labor and employment lawyer in that law firm. So certainly look to a firm that has a team of individuals that can assist you.
And your firm, Lancaster, Mix & Welch, where you're a partner, I know you have a number of specialists. I mean, I've had my real estate lawyer is there, and I mean, there are a number of specialties within your firm to address the variety of issues for business owners, correct?
Yes, that's right. It's not uncommon for me to walk down the hallway and talk to one of our corporate guys when a clinic or an owner comes in and says, I have this problem. What should I do? And I'll say, well, that's not my area of expertise, but let's walk down the hallway and we'll get some corporate advice for you right away.
Thank you, Leanne. Well, we're at the end of our show, and I have a few thank yous. I want to thank you to all the people who listened tonight on our webcast. I think it was one of the most interesting webcasts we've had so far in the 10-week program. I want to thank Tamara Booth from Montreal. We had a number of people respond to our question, and the answer to the question was anthropology was the third point of study that Leanne did back at Carleton. And that's Tamara Booth from Montreal, and we'll be sending you out a copy of Better Business Agreements. I want to remind our listeners, anyone who's out east, I will be in Nova Scotia next weekend speaking on this very topic at the Massage Therapists Association of Nova Scotia conference. I'll be speaking on Better Business Agreements. And, of course, last but not least, Leanne, I want to thank you very much for agreeing to come on the show. The legal issues around Better Business Agreements are very contentious and very painful in the massage therapy profession, and you've been able to shed some light on a lot of these problems, and I hope that a number of our listeners will take advantage and contact you to contract some of your services so that they can have a better business agreement in place in advance before they have any problems. So, Leanne, thank you very much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And good night to everyone, and please remember that you can hear replays of the MT Coach Series 10 Weeks to a Better Business by visiting www.mtcoach.com. Good night, everyone.